That story, I don't know if you caught that, was from the Vancouver riots that happened last year at the end of the hockey series. The Canucks had lost to the Bruins, and everybody thought that they were going to win the series. And so, of course, everybody did what you would normally do when your hockey team loses, and you take to the streets and destroy the city. After all, if we can't win a hockey game, then we shouldn't even bother having a city. I think it was kind of the sentiment. And there's a really weird echo. You guys hear that? A really weird echo in there with me. I don't know if you can get that out of there, but we'll work on it. You just turn me down, maybe. I don't know. My first thought when I saw that was, it's hockey. I mean, really, you're going to ride over hockey? I mean, at least pick a good sport to ride over if you're going to ride over something. Sorry, it's just what I thought. My next thought was, it's hockey. I mean, really, it's not a big deal. What are you doing riding over hockey? And you watch it, and you see people in the midst of that. People are there, you know, destroying cars and burning stuff and beating in stores. And you just got to think about it. There's some guy who worked all of his life, saved up his money, and he started this cell phone shop. And a hockey team loses, and his shop gets destroyed. How is that fair in life? Worse yet, when some guy stands up and does the right thing and does what you would want to do. He does what's in line with the heart of God even in that moment. I don't know if you're like me, but I sort of get frustrated that God doesn't intervene at that moment. You know, because it's kind of like I stand up and do what's right, and as you saw in the video, these unsung heroes get beaten for what they do. They stand up, it's like, oh, what are you doing? And somebody beats them up. Another guy, he stands there and tries to keep people from lighting fires, and they throw him to the ground, and they kick him, and they stomp him. And so that guy goes to the hospital tonight with wounds and bruises for having stood up and done what was right. And in that moment, you think to yourself, where is God in the midst of all this? I mean, I thought we'd come to church and we talk about this God who can raise his own son from the dead, but he can't seem to help out somebody in a city that's full of rioters. I don't get that. And sometimes I almost read the Bible and I sort of feel like it reads like an infomercial for Jesus, you know? You kind of read through and it's like all these people, they all trusted God and everything great happened. I mean, we go through the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. We've been going through this series. You've been with us for a while. We've been studying Hebrews 11. And just story after story, it's like they come to some major crisis in their life, and God shows up. I mean, you got a guy who doesn't have any kids. He doesn't have a land. And God says, just come over here. I'll give you kids, and I'll give you land. And sure enough, God does it. You got another guy who says, you know, why don't you go to the most powerful nation on the face of the earth and rescue my people? And so he goes, and he does it. And then he gets this problem. He's right before Red Sea, and God parts the Red Sea for him. And over and over and over again, that you see there's this God who when they come up on a city that's fortified with these huge walls, all they do is just march around it, and God takes care of the rest. And so you read story after story after that, and then you look at your own life, and you say, what about me? It doesn't seem like as if this is happening in my life. How come this isn't happening for me? And it's almost like as if less you think that Hebrews is some sort of infomercial for Jesus. I love how he ends out the chapter, and he ends out the chapter in Hebrews chapter 11, and he says this, and what more shall I say? I don't even have time to go on to talk about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and to tell you about David and Samuel and all the prophets who through faith they conquered kingdoms and administered justice and gained what was promised. They shut the mouths of lions and quenched the fiery flames, and they escaped the sword, and whose weakness was turned to strength, whose power in battle routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, and they were raised to life again. It's almost like he's just going through story after story. These are the stories we tell all of our kids over in the kids' wing every single Sunday morning. And Jackson will come home, my son will come home, and tell me about how, you know, that God shut the mouths of the lions in the lion's den. And wasn't that so cool, Daddy? He could go pet the kitties. I mean, he loves this stuff. But lest you think this is all one big infomercial for Jesus, it's as if, like on the infomercials they have in like really small print when some guy's trying to get you to buy into his pyramid marketing scheme. What's a really small print say? Results not typical. You know? And instead of in really, really small print, it's almost like as if he says, I'm going to devote the last part of this chapter to let you know these results are not typical. There is other things out there that happen. He says, but there were others. Lest you think this is what happens every single time somebody places their faith in God, I just want to let you know there were others who, refusing to be released, they were tortured so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning, and they were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. And they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and living in caves and in holes in the ground. And these were all committed for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. Since God had planned for something better for us also, that together with us, they might be made perfect. You know, I understand why the TV preachers give the health and wealth gospel, and I get that. Because as a pastor, what happens over and over and over again and throughout my life is that week after week, hardly a week goes by that somebody doesn't come to me and share with me, I mean, just the absolute worst moment of life. And they come to me and they say, you know, here's what's going on. Here's what God put on my plate. And I've got this thing going on with my son. I've got this thing going on with my marriage. I've got this thing going on in my life. I've got this disease and doctors don't even know what it is. And we're not really sure what the cure is. And I just want to come to you and just tell me what is it that I can do to get God to act on my behalf? I so desperately long just to want to have a baby, and I can't have a baby, and the doctors tell me it's not possible, and I so desperately want God just to intervene. You just tell me what it is I need to do, and I will do it, and I will be there. If it means I got to show up at church more, I'll show up at church more. If I got to give more, I'll give more. If I need to pray more, I'll pray more. Just tell me what is it that I can do to evoke God to give me the kind of response that we've been reading about in Hebrews chapter 11, where they come upon a Red Sea and God parts it, where Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den, and he shuts up the mouths of the lion, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego jump into the fiery furnace, and they just walk around there and have a party in the fire. Tell me what it is I got to do to get God to act on my behalf, and I'll do it. And it's in that moment that as your pastor, I just so desperately want to lie to you. I don't know what else to say. You feel that pressure. I want to tell you, well, if you just do these five things, it'll happen. We got small groups signed up, and if you'll help me get that signed up, then we'll get you the miracle you need. If you just show up every week to church, then you'll get that. And it's very, really conflicting because on the one hand, it's like, I know God can do it, but I don't have any promises that he's going to do it for you right now. I know too many verses to tell you what you want to hear. I know too many verses to lie to you. I know things about, like, one of my favorite stories is the story of Jonathan and his armor bearer, and the situation that he finds himself in is where he and the army of God are down to about 600 people, and they've got two swords left. And they're facing a very well-equipped, heavily armed military force with thousands of men that are coming upon them. And Jonathan wakes up in the middle of the night, and he says to his armor bearer, and he says, hey, why don't we go over there and pick a fight? Because I know that whether there is many or few, nothing can hinder our Lord from coming through for us. And those are the verses you love. Those are the verses you put on t-shirts. Those are the verses that get the rally cry up there that, hey, let's get up and let's go pick a fight. I don't care if there's just two of us. I don't care if we only got one sword between the two of us. Let's go pick a fight because nothing can hinder God from saving us. But he adds after that, perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Perhaps. Maybe. Like, I know God can do this, but you got to know going in, if we go up there, we have no guarantee he's going to come through for us in this moment. And if you've walked with God any length of time, at some point, you're going to get frustrated with God because he doesn't always come through. In this passage, what the writer of Hebrews shares about, he makes his transition right there in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35. He says that there were these women who got their sons back from the dead, and he's, of course, talking about the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, who there's these two ladies that both of them ministered to, and they lost their sons, and God brought them back from the dead. But then right after that, he says, but there were others who were tortured. And what he's referring to there is about 200 years before Jesus came, Rome had come in and invaded the land, and they'd put this guy named Antiochus as the ruler, the governor, the prefect over the area there. Kind of like what the role that Pilate had in Jesus' day, this guy named Antiochus had back about 200 years before. And Antiochus made it against the law, against the law of the day to be a Jew. And he really just kind of found it almost comical the way that these Jews would not eat pork, that they would have nothing to do with pigs. And so he actually, this is a guy, maybe you may have heard of the guy who went into the temple of God and sacrificed a pig on the altar purposefully just to offend the people. And in the historical account of that he's referring to here, it's a book called Second Maccabees. It tells a story of a mother who had seven sons. And he brought this mother out before her seven sons, and tried to force them all to eat pork. And they wouldn't do it. And so one by one, Antiochus went through and each one of her sons killed. And he tortured them and brutally beat them and say, will you just eat? Will you just eat? And it says in there that each one of her sons went to his death. And it tells in there what they said before they died. I just want to read to you one of them, which I can't help but think is what the writer of Hebrews is pointing out. After torturing them, they asked him, will you eat pork rather than having your body tortured limb by limb? And he answered them in the language of his ancestors, and he said, never. And so he, in turn, endured the same suffering that his brothers had had. And with his last breath, he cried, you accursed fiend, you were depriving us of this present life, but the King of the universe will raise us up to live forever, to live forever. And so the writer of Hebrews says, yes, there were some women who got their kids back, but there were other women, if you remember, whose sons were tortured, and they held out for a better resurrection. This is a real story. This really happened. We read through stories of faith, and because we know the ending, we don't always realize the struggle that people went through in those moments. He mentions in here about the guys who went through the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But if you read back and you look carefully at their story, they say to the king back in Daniel chapter 3, they say, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown in the blazing furnace, our God's able to save us from it. He can rescue us from your hand. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know that we're not going to serve your gods. And we kind of skip over that, but even if we don't line, because we know that God came through for them, and so we want to talk about how God came through for them. But when you look at it, we almost ask ourselves, what kind of faith is it to say, God, I know you can do anything, but even if you don't? Because we're told in our life that if you have faith, you're going to believe that God will heal you. If you have faith, you're going to believe that God will come through for you. If you have faith, you will believe. And some people even tell you, the reason why you don't have your miracles is because you don't believe enough. Ever been told that? Your problem is you just don't have enough faith. Well, when I look at the faith of the people who God actually came through for, they're still saying, but hey, we don't really know whether or not God's going to come through for us or not. We know he can. We don't know if he will. And at some point in your life of faith, in your walk with God, if you walk with him any time, you're going to come to the conclusion that Jeremiah came to. Jeremiah was a prophet who was called since the time he was born to serve and follow after God. And at one point, he gets to the point, he says, God, you've deceived me. You've deceived me, and I allowed you to deceive me. I stood up for what was right, and now I've become a household joke. And maybe you felt that way at some point in your life where you looked at God and you say, God, you've deceived me. I trusted you. I followed after you. And you know, we hear about Jesus coming out of the tomb, and sure, you do that for him. We hear about, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego getting, you know, coming out of the fire furnace. And sure, you do that for them. But what about me, God? Because what about me? Or are you going to come through for me? I love what one of the writers said about this. He said, the greatest challenge in our life is to cultivate such a deep and satisfying relationship with God that we rest in him, whether we're living or dying, comfortable or miserable, that we might cultivate the unshakable confidence that God himself is better than anything life can give us or death can take away from us. And this is the faith that Hebrews speaks of. That being in God's presence is better than anything life can give us or anything death can take away from us. It's the same faith that Job had when he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. I love the way the New Living Translation puts that verse. It says, you know, God might kill me, but I don't have any other hope. God, it's up to you, man. I'm going to stand up for what is right. I'm going to do what is right. I'm going to stand up in the midst of these rioters, and they might kill me, God. But hey, I don't have any other hope but you anyway. You know, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do what is right. And maybe that's going to mean I get mocked and ridiculed for it. Maybe it means I'm an outcast. Maybe it means I have no friends. Maybe it means that my whole life is filled with misery and I never get healed from this. But you know something, God? I don't have anywhere else to put my hope in except for you. You're all I have, so I can trust in you. So you might ask, how do we get to the point where we have a faith like Job where we say, God, you might kill me, but I have no other hope? It's down in verse 39 and 40 where it says, but God had planned something better for us that only together with us they might be made perfect. And what's he talking about, something better for us? He's going back and saying that we might attain that better resurrection. And the writer of Hebrews is looking to his audience. And there are people who were facing immense persecution and suffering. And the question that really comes out is how can we have faith in God in the midst of everything we're facing right now? And he says, listen, you and me have something that all these people I've mentioned here didn't have. You and me are living in a day and a time where we've seen something and we've experienced something and we have a story of God that these people never had. So you and I should have all the more opportunity to do far greater and better things than they did. And what you and I have is what we come here today to celebrate and to remember and to talk about. And that is, in fact, what you and I have today is the knowledge that God sent his only son to this earth, who lived a sinless life, died on a cross, and rose from the dead and lived to tell about it. You see, what's unique about Christianity is it's not a religion. A religion is based on teachings. It's based on a philosophy. It's based on basically filling the gap between what we know and what we want to know is out there. It's this question. Most religions come up where I've got this problem. I don't know what the answer is. And so tell me something. Tell me some mystery. And so that's where people back in the ancient of days, they'd see lightning come down from the sky. And they'd say, what is that? And they'd say, well, that's God. His name is Thor and he's mad. So he's throwing stuff down at us. Or those are two people up in heaven fighting. And so the gods are having an argument. And that's what lightning is. That's religion. We don't come here to celebrate a religion. We don't come here to celebrate a teaching, some philosophy. We come here this morning to celebrate an event, something that happened in history. Just a couple of years ago, the Newsweek magazine, 2005, their cover story was entitled this, How Jesus Became the Christ, From Resurrection to the Rise of Christianity. And you kind of wonder yourself, what is Newsweek going to say about Jesus? Well, it might shock you. It says, this is writer John Meacham. This isn't like some Christian evangelical publication. This is just a secular writer, John Meacham, writing about it. He says, and why did Christianity succeed where so many other religion and spiritual movements failed? That's the question he has. You know, look back and there's tons, there's thousands of religious movements throughout history. Why is it that this one succeeded? This is the question he went and sought to answer. He said, for the religious, the lesson is that those closest to Jesus accepted very little blindly. Did you get what he's saying here? People didn't just have a blind faith. People didn't just take things on what he said by his word. People didn't accept what he was saying, just, you know, oh, whatever he says, I'm going to do. It wasn't like Jesus had a bunch of blind followers who didn't question everything. He says, but rather, in the words of Origen of Alexandria, an early church father, it is far better to accept these teachings with reason and with wisdom than mere faith. He says, if you're going to listen to what Jesus says, it's better to use wisdom than just mere faith. He says, for the secular, there's a reminder that Christianity has endured 2 millennia of creative intellectual thought and innovation, a blend of history that is considered to be a theological debate. And that should slow the occasional rush to dismiss the faithful as superstitious or simple. He's saying, listen, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe in Jesus, don't be so quick to call them religious nuts, because for 2,000 years people have been questioning what they believed and nobody's come up with a good alternative. So just think about that for a minute. For 2,000 years people have been questioning these Jesus followers and nobody has any answer for what it is that's going on. For 2,000 years the best intellectual minds in the world, and that should just say something to you, say, whoa, there's something to this. He goes on and he says, without the resurrection, it is virtually impossible to imagine that the Jesus movement of the first decades of the first century would have endured. As a matter of history, however, scholars agree that the two oldest pieces of the New Testament tradition speak of Jesus rising from the dead. In other words, a lot of people recently have tried to say, hey, you know, this whole idea that Jesus rose from the dead, that was just a later tradition that sprang up just to try to, and, you know, bolster the movement, just to get people to follow in, just to get people to get, kind of blindly move in. He says, no, the very earliest traditions, we're talking stuff that was written within 10, 20 years of his death while people were still around who could have refuted it. And so he says the uniqueness, or one might say even the oddity or the implausibility of the story of Jesus and his resurrection argues that tradition is more likely historical than just some theological construct. With this secular writing, I'll just kind of give you a very easy breakdown. What he's saying is, like it or not, the most plausible explanation is that it happened. And if you deny that it happened, well, then you've got to come up with some reason for why you deny that. You can't just say, well, I don't believe it happened. Because when you move to the point where I just don't believe it happened, he says, you're closer to blind faith at that point than you are to solid reasoning. Because all evidence is pointing to the fact that as implausible and as odd as it may sound, there historically was a guy named Jesus who crucified on a cross, and he rose from the dead. Because there is no other way to explain how both Greeks and Hebrews, who didn't have in their worldview a concept of resurrection, who didn't have in their worldview the concept of God sending his son who would die on a cross. Their idea was that God would come as this conquering hero, this military might. And all these people, overnight, move from, I don't think there's a resurrection, I don't think life after death is possible, I don't believe that God would send his son on this earth to die. They go from that worldview and that understanding to thousands of them overnight saying, there is a God, his son was Jesus and he rose from the dead. And there's no other way to explain that. Other than to come back and say, there is a God and his name is Jesus and he rose from the dead. And so if you're going to deny that reality, that the burden is on you to prove and explain what exactly happened there in the first century. You might say, okay, I get that. So how do you connect here? Is God going to come through for me with the historical reliability of the resurrection? Well, it's this. If you come here this morning to truly celebrate, to commemorate the resurrection of somebody, what you're saying then is saying, God, it really is possible. It really is likely. Perhaps you might even say it really is true that this feeling that I have inside that something happens after we die, that when I go to a funeral, that's not the end. There's something in me. There's this urge that says to me, I'll see this person again. And what you're saying at the cross of Jesus Christ in the resurrection from the tomb is that's not just a feeling. That's not just a hope. That's not just a whimsical idea. As this chapter begins off, that's not just a hope. He says, but faith is being sure of what we hope for. And we're sure of what we hope for because we've seen the resurrected Jesus Christ. We don't just have a hope that something happens after this life. We don't just have a hope that maybe there's life after death. We have a faith. We have a faith which is being sure of what we hope for because we've seen the life of Jesus Christ and we know that he rose from the dead. So I don't just hope that something happens after we die, but I know something happens because Jesus Christ has proved it out in my life. And so if the death of Jesus Christ proves anything to us, it proves two things. One is that God doesn't always come through in this life. But he does make something good out of it. Jesus prayed in the garden, God, can you just come through for me right now? Take this cup from me. I don't want to have to go through this. Can you just take this cup from me and let this all pass over and do this some other way? And of course, the obvious answer to that question was no. But let us not forget that Jesus also finished that prayer by saying, God, but not what I want, but whatever you want. You know, God, I want your story for me to be that you shut up the mouths of lions, that you quench the fiery furnace. That's what I want your story for me to be. But God, even if it isn't, I accept that. Because I know that in Jesus, you can do amazing things, that even the most tragic moment can lead to the greatest glory. You ever wonder why Jesus kept his scars after he rose from the dead? I mean, we read these stories about when you're in heaven, you have this glorified body that has no more crying, no more pain, no more tears. And wouldn't you want a body that didn't have any battle wounds on it? Wouldn't you want a body that was just kind of perfect? But what you see in the life of Jesus with his scars and his hands on his wounds is his scars are all the more beautiful than a perfect hand. Because on that hand, you see that he went to the cross and he died for you and for me, and he did it. He lived it out. He lived out what he believed. He lived out what it was true. And you look at those scars and you say, how beautiful. We just sang a song, how beautiful the blood flow. That Jesus is all the more beautiful to me, not because he lived a perfect life, but because he was willing to lay down his life for me. And when he says you'll obtain a better resurrection, he's saying that what God can do in your life because of what you do for him right now, what he can do for all eternity is so much better than anything you could get right now. Because after all, isn't all healing temporary? Isn't all financial windfall momentary? I mean, people win the lottery, they lose it within a few years. Article yesterday about Warren Sapp. you know, great football player out of Tampa Bay, broke. Finances are temporary. Health is temporary. Even these women who received back their sons from the dead that in Elijah and Elisha's day, those kids died. They're not still here with us. And he says, listen, you know what's better than receiving your son back? You know what's better than God quenching the fiery furnace? A resurrection. What you can never lose is better than what you can get for a short time. He says, God has something better planned for us. God has a better hope for us. So the question is, are you willing to live a life that honors God and reflects his character and leaves the outcome up to him? When you get to that moment in life when you realize that the road that God is leading you down isn't an outcome you like, are you willing to say, God, I'm going to go forward in this? Because I know if Jesus' life proves anything, if Easter proves anything to me, it proves me this, that you can do amazing things even in a life that's given to you in sacrifice. Even if I never get what I want, there's something better out there for me. And if you get thrown to the lions, you know, like you, I hope that you'll be there in the morning to celebrate. But if you're not, you'll be in the presence of God. And you'll provide a today's treat for the lions. And if you truly believe in the resurrection, if you truly come here to celebrate that Jesus rose from the dead, it'll change how you see your life. And no longer will you say, God, I only trust you for what I want you to do for me. You'll just say, God, I trust you no matter what. My faith in you, God, is not in what I have for my agenda for you. My faith in you, God, is just in you. And I'm looking forward to that better resurrection. No matter what I go through right now, God, I know it's only temporary. No matter what I'm struggling with right now, God, I know it's going to end. And there will come a day I'm with you. And I know that because of Easter. I know that because of what happened. So as we conclude out of this, I ask, do you have that same faith? Do you have that belief? And if your life is one of an unsung hero, are you okay with that? Will you join with me as we close? Fathers, we look to your cross and we look to your son. We look to your resurrection. Father, may we not forget what the writer of Hebrews says, is that we have this hope that there is life after death. We have this hope that if we give our life for a worthy cause, it'll have been worth it. But because of Easter, Father, we can move from hope to faith. We can be sure of what we hope for, because we have evidence of something that we never thought was possible. So, Father, right now there's folks in this room who are struggling with you right now, Lord, because they're disappointed. They feel betrayed. Because at their greatest moment of need, you didn't show up for them. But, Father, may they realize and may they understand this morning, there's a bigger picture here. There's more to life than our 70 or 80 years on this earth. There's an eternity. And what Easter shows us, Father, is that there is something after this life. That we might trust in your Son and share in his resurrection. In Jesus' name, amen. So at this time, normally, that we come up for communion. And we come up and we share and we remember the very last night that Jesus was here on the earth with us, and that he shared his body and his blood, and he took bread and he broke it. He says, this is my bread, this is my body which is broken for you for the forgiveness of sins. And this is my cup which was poured out for you. And on Thursday night this past week, we shared in just kind of a remembrance of what that very first Lord's Supper was like. And Bobby and I got to talking about it afterwards, and if we look at Easter on Sunday morning, we said, you know, is Easter really a time that we want to go back and remember and remind ourselves of the death on the cross, or is it a time we want to focus on the resurrection of the Son? This came back and you said, this is the one Sunday morning where we just want to celebrate the risen Lord. I saw a video this past year called He's Alive. It so moved me. It was moved me to tears. I just sat there and just the reality of the resurrection hit home. And my hope for you as you leave here today is that the reality of the resurrection just might hit you. Because until it does, everything I've said this morning, everything you've worshipped, everything you say you believe, doesn't really matter. And so my hope is that you'll just sit there and you'll just put yourself back in that day and that time. Because right now, you may not be really sure whether or not you believe. And you got to know this. Nobody was sure they could believe it until they saw it with their own eyes. And Jesus says, blessed are you, that though you haven't seen me, you still believe. And for us, we believe the testimony of those who saw it and experienced and lived it. My hope this morning is you'll leave here today with that testimony to share as well. So just sit back and watch this.